Hey guys, today I'm talking to Jesse Zaretti, composer for film, games, producer of bands in the band Doth, Kiesel artist. Jesse is rad. I first met him back when Before Threat was playing shows with Binary Code, one of his longtime projects. Jesse's just continued to grind away and do more awesome stuff as time goes on. So this was a really cool one. If you're interested in the world of music outside of playing and band stuff, if you're starting to think about production and composition and the world of film and games and stuff, this is a really good one for you. So check it out.
Tinkering with ChatGPT. Do you ever use this for even just for fun?
I not yet, but I will be doing something with it at some point, I'm sure.
Okay. We plugged in the other day who is the current and former lineup of Everforth, right? Just for shits. And this is even a different list of names than we got the other day. Like I have no idea who Chris Alfano is. I guess you do. Does he at least play bass?
He does.
He does.
He's okay. A great guitar player too.
Cool. I don't know Joe Fatum. Former members Kevin Theodore played keys, right? Not guitars. My brother played bass. I don't know Louis Mora, and I don't know Mike Lunapieta. So I actually typed in. Who's Jesse Zaretti to see how accurate this is. And it didn't pick it up at first. And I said, it's composer for Marvel and member of the band Doth. And it said, I apologize for my earlier response. So I'm curious how right this is. Cause I wanted to get like a sense of some of the stuff you've worked on over the past decade, but I didn't want a Wikipedia and stuff like that. I wanted to ask ChatGPT.
This is great.
So I'm curious. So I'll read it out and you kind of help me. Jesse Zaretti is an American musician and composer who has worked in the film and television industry. He is best known for his work as a composer for Marvel Entertainment and as a former member of the heavy metal band Doth. Former is not correct.
Correct, yeah. Oh, man, I see some good stuff in there.
Okay, here it comes. As a composer, Zaretti has contributed to the music scores for various Marvel projects, including Marvel's Spider-Man.
Sure. Yep.
Okay. Marvel Rising Secret Warriors.
Yes.
Yes. He has also worked on music for television shows such as The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills and Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
No. If anything, I think it's my friend Randy Slaw they're confusing me with. He definitely has done something with one of those shows.
Okay.
Oh, man, that's funny. Let's see what else.
Before his work in film and television, Zaretti was a member of the band.
Yeah. I guess I quit. I didn't realize it.
Yeah. Well, actually, the last time that we did this, maybe I don't know what'll happen if I hit this 10 times, but it said in 2013, Nick Lorandi left the band and was replaced by Nick Lorandi. It's like, okay.
By your doppelganger? Yeah. Your multiverse version?
Yeah. Like a bizarro came in with like a scar on his face. Okay, so you were Zaretti was a member was of yeah, for his work in
currently
film, Zaretti, yeah a death metal band from Atlanta, Georgia. He played guitar and provided backing vocals for the band, which was active from 2003 to 2013.
Yeah, not correct.
No, okay.
That's very funny.
All right, we're almost through this. In addition to his work in music, Zaretti has also been involved in the video game industry, working on sound design for games such as Batman Arkham Origins and Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon Future Soldier.
Nope. I wish.
No. Okay. Well, we'll get to the things you actually did in a sec. Okay. Overall, Jesse is a multi-talented musician and composer who had made significant contributions to various industries, including film, television, music, and video games.
That's very nice.
That's very nice of it to say. Like, I apologize for all the shit I fucked up, but he's very talented.
That's very funny. I love that so much. Yeah. I think I might copy that onto my bio and just leave it as is.
Yeah. Well, the good thing about this is you just rerun it and you'll get a bunch of different fun
I love that.
Fun answers. So yeah, the last time I saw you in person was at a show in Jersey. I don't even remember the name of the place. Architects or something. Yeah. Architect. I don't think it's there anymore.
It might be. I know Kurt, the, he was one of the owners. He might have sold his part to George, who I think may still have it. It's like a multifaceted endeavor. I know Kurt. He's the drummer for a band called 100,000, and my friend Andrew plays bass for them. I actually jammed with them one time.
Oh, it is still here. Architect Music.
Yeah.
Lessons and all that stuff. Oh, I got to hit them up to play again.
It's a nice venue. It's a pretty small spot. I don't know if they do shows anymore, though. That's the only thing. I feel like that's probably not a thing anymore. But they do lessons, and they recorded a Seven Dust record there, too.
Oh, I remember that. That had happened before we even played there, I think.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Like a place where they also do kids lessons. They record Seven Dust album.
That's pretty neat. It's a good idea in theory. It's just, it's a tough endeavor.
To have a studio as well as a music space, a lesson space.
Especially when they're like right next to each other and there's no way to, like, it's like you got to pick one or the other. Are you going to record somebody? Are you going to have a show? Or are you going to have lessons? Which one are you going to do?
Yeah.
Can't do it all at the same time.
Yeah. I do want to talk about some more of that. Just like generally, what is the right balance of stuff? You know what I mean? Oh, but, God.
Is there a right balance?
Yeah, let's just get into it right now. I did want to clarify some of the stuff you've been up to over the last, you know, over the last bunch of years. Like, so binary code is, I don't know if you necessarily want this information out there. We could delete or whatever, but that's still a band, I suppose, binary code.
Yeah. I mean, I think binary code's going to be a thing no matter what. It'll probably just be a place that, you know, for band-oriented metal stuff that I write with my singer will probably always exist as long as we want to do that. But as far as playing shows go,
really? I
have no desire to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Live performance period, is you're over it?
I, in the band capacity, like the metal world, yes. It's a little complicated because the cost benefit of doing metal stuff live versus being near my studio is very it's imbalanced greatly. Even with Doth, like I don't know what the plan is for us. So it's just, everything is just complicated. AL's busy too. You know, he's got URM and Riff Hard and I'm just real settled into not playing live.
I mean, and putting on a single performance is fuck ton of work, especially if you have guys coming from different parts of the country.
Other countries. Yeah. Krim's in Austria.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just played my music for the first time live this past weekend, and I did a duo, you know, with Jared on drums.
I saw that. It was crazy.
Thanks. I'm going to put up some fun highlights sooner or later. But I was like, look, this is the way that I can afford to do this right now. Like, you take a couple days to learn the music. We'll do two rehearsals. I'm not going to sweat scheduling with two more people. You know, if I was to do it right, it would be a keyboard player who first of all had all the right equipment to get all the right sounds that I want and like had my vision in their head, who'd probably want a lot of money to spend the time to do all that.
Right.
And then a bass player, then coordinating four people for a handful of rehearsals. It's just way, way, way too much. And then to get paid. You know, I think I heard you talking about this a little bit with just generally performing live as a metal band, a little bit with your podcast with Eyal.
Oh yeah,
you and him chatting a couple months ago.
Yeah, the Riff Hard one. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Just performing in general is tough, and then you need a handful of openers and.
It's a risk. That's why you have to do it because you really want to and just expect nothing, which is kind of a good way to approach it. But I feel like I've talked about doing this before, but a lot of the kind of video game related music stuff that I'm working on would be very cool to do live, but it would have to be treated more as kind of like, I was talking to my friend, his name's Audio Freak. That's like his his group name. He's a really like hard style, distortion heavy, kind of hard dance music type of guy who travels the world and plays in front of like 6,000 people. And it's like a light show more than it's anything. And I think that's how I would have to do it, is like a really cool light show and then just like backing tracks. Because first off, you and I talked about it, but it's the stuff that I do, like the Doom Eternal style stuff, is two people playing it at the same time sounds really difficult. It's hard enough to track it. You know, it's not like complicated. We're not talking like Wayne Krantz or anything like that. It's just the bending intervals.
Well, it's hard in a different way to get two guitars to do 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 do. To do that is really fucking hard. And I write riffs all the time that are like, you know, chun 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 do chun 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 do, you know, like that.
Like pre-bends, yeah.
Pretty little, yeah, things like that. And you know, getting that to sync up perfectly between two guitars and a bass is really hard. So I have to like loop a section a zillion times and be like, okay, that was the one. That was the one where like all three instruments were actually in tune with each other.
Yeah. Yeah, doing the bending, and some of these intervals are huge too. Like we're talking like three whole step bends sometimes. You know, it's like real, it's big. It's not like a like a whole step. You know, it's that's fine. But and also the riff kind of relies on staying on one fret and just bending endlessly and finding these. It almost kind of reminds me of the South Park theme, like, you know, that weird whamola thing that Les Claypool uses, where it's just like a giant crank that he uses to change the pitch of things. You know, the South Park theme.
Yeah, I'm trying is it that part that he's using the crank?
Yeah, it's just one string. It looks like a string bass, kind of, and he just bends it with this weird lever.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's a very similar concept to what's being done, except it's all in the fingers. You know, if I had more control with a bar, I'm like, as I'm saying this to you, I'm like, man, maybe I should like have one of those built. That could be really cool. It makes things so much easier for me, because it really sucks to do on guitar.
And I'm thinking of like, I was going to ask, like, could something like Evertune make your life easier? But that's the opposite. It would actually make your life harder, because you can't.
You could do bending on an Evertune.
You just flip it the other, you like turn it off, right?
Yeah. All of the guitars behind me, like my 6, 7, and 8 have Evertune. And it makes things easier in terms of like, okay, cool, I did all this crazy bending and the guitar's still in tune at the end of that. Mm. But it doesn't change the microtonal nature of the bends, you know?
Yeah. So how are you doing it? Do you track? Those are guitar parts you're tracking, right? You're not running through like a virtual guitar to get micro stuff?
I will use a virtual, like a Impact Soundworks Hydra. I'll use that to dictate the intervals that I want, and then come back and retrack the guitars, quad track it.
Gotcha.
It's hard.
You're using computer math to do it perfectly, and then
use my ear to play along, basically
to do the best play along to it. Yeah, I gotcha.
I did just get the Fishman triple play, which they have some announcements about that product that'll be like later this year. But they make that the Fishman triple play technology is great, because it at least gives me my bending intervals in the software, so it kind of puts it out in MIDI, and I can use that for a synth to kind of follow along to what I'm doing. But it doesn't change the fact that I have to do it three more times after I do it one time that I like, which is,
yeah,
I do a lot of correction in transposition in Cubase. Like I'll find the section where it's like, this is out, and then I'll just, you know, micro tune it until it's right. And sometimes it sounds a little off, and sometimes it sounds good. You know, I feel like sometimes it sounds cool when things are a little off. Meshuga does that a little bit. It's like just barely off. It makes it sound human.
Okay, so what happened after? Did you get into this stuff shortly after kind of hanging up the live shows with Binary Code? Like how did you transition to the video games, the TV composition? How that all happened?
Yes. So we were on tour with Leprous in 2016, and we played our home date, New York City. and made friends with some people at Marvel. And then later on, we finished tracking Memento Mori, which came out in 2020, but we finished tracking it in 2017. And around that time, I kind of reconnected with the Marvel folks and became close with some of the people there. And it just I came up with an idea of writing music to characters from Marvel, kind of like linear theme style. And yeah, it was just kind of from that point forward, it was like, how do I create opportunities from this? And yeah, so I came up with this idea for linear themes. It turned into a series and wrote a ton of music while working full time as a creative director for a musical instrument company. And then we won a Webby Award for the first series that I did. And then from that point forward, it was just like, all right, let's turn this into a career. And I quit my day job and just threw myself to the wolves and just made it happen. So, and the Doom style stuff, was kind of a challenge for myself. Somebody showed it to me. My drummer, Austin, he was like, yeah, man, you should check out the soundtrack. Mick Gordon's really good. I had no idea who he was. And, this was 2020. So it was like right when the pandemic started. And I was like, dude, I can write stuff like this. And he's like, really? It's so hard to do. And I'm like, I don't know about that, dude. It sounds like Meshuggah plus Nine Inch Nails and like Godflesh or something.
Yeah.
And I just gave it a shot. It's not like it was perfect right up in the front, but it was a good attempt at it. And people seemed to really like it. Like it kind of, anything I've done with Binary Code didn't take off the way that did for me. So I just kept following it. And then, yeah, it's people like it. We're going to do a Nail the Mix with URM for it. George Lever is going to do that. And then we're doing some other stuff. I might do a Riff Hard if it makes sense to do, because I think it is it's a really undercovered. I don't know the best way to say it. It's an undercreated style. Like people try to create it, but they get the band element down. It's like, oh, cool. You got the guitars and the drums. You don't have the bending. You don't have the sound design. You don't have the production style. It's not cinematic. It's just basically like a down tempo djent thing. And
yeah, I don't think I've really heard very many, because these aren't really bands. These would be artists doing this, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Like I haven't really heard any artists doing like good, like you know, evil video game style metal.
Yeah, it's not easy.
I mean I'm trying to think of an example, but it doesn't exist. I think because also when you kind of get into that space of solo artist stuff, it turns into like being the best, it turns into being like another quote unquote like prog player, like right. It turns into solos and yep. Kind of the thing that I'm doing.
Yeah. Which is great for that style.
Yeah, it's got a place. It's certainly got a place. But yeah, you don't hear many or any really like artists saying, you know what, I'm going to really just break off a piece of this thing right here. And that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, well, sound design is an element of audio that is just not a very explored area for a lot of
metal well, tell guys. Me what that is, because I had a note here to ask you about sound design and what that means. Because also when I spoke to Aaron Marshall, he had mentioned he was working with you on sound design. And to this day, I'm like, I wonder what that meant.
Well, with him, so the new interval stuff was a lot of synth work. So I basically just kind of acted as a synth producer, I guess you could say. He gave me all the stuff he wanted, but it was like, hey, make cool synth sounds. You know, we did some arranging over it too, and some, you know, just making it sound
better. Synth, pretty much non-guitar consultant.
Yeah.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, Aaron has such a cool thing going. His pre-production stuff sounds like a record. It's kind of unfair.
Yeah, I noticed that on Instagram. I'm like, how did you do this?
I wonder if Sam built him a template. I don't know, but it's possible. It sounds amazing. And it's like, how do we make this sound better? It's a real challenge. So it basically comes down to synth designing, which is a whole other thing that is done. It's very much a technical game of like building things from scratch instead of, oh, I bought Omnisphere and then I clicked this thing and then went over here, which I've done before, and you get great starting points from that, but it's just building things from scratch is fun, like in Serum or something. And yeah, I really wanted to bring in like a lot of the 80s and maybe even like late 70s kind of really heavy jazz fusion type of stuff to the table with what he was doing. I'm a huge, probably like you, Holdsworth nerd. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just wanted to kind of bring some of that to the table, but then also bring some of the more like Robert Glasper, Terrace Martin kind of stuff to the table too. You know, just really cool analog bass playing, I guess you could say.
Yes. Yeah. Some mono.
Yeah.
Mono synth.
Real type. Fat bass stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then also doing cool like sound design stuff with drums and making the drums kind of turn into like just rhythmic sounds more than they are identified as like a drum kit or something is also part of it. But to answer your question, like sound design to me is not focusing on melodic, basically, you know, like, this is an 8-inch tom. Let's forget the idea that this is a tom. Let's turn it into something else. Maybe it's going to be like more like white noise or something. It could also just be kind of what it sounds like sound. It's just sound sometimes. It can be impacts or hits or risers, stuff like that. In the game,
and you're not talking about taking a tom hit and then morphing it. You're talking about sure, building sometimes. Something. Sometimes, but yeah. this could also be just from the ground up. Like, what are the fundamental elements of a tom hit? And let me see if I can shape that, but then also do something else.
Yeah, or like what happens after you hit the tom, not when you hit the tom. So it's like, let's get a really cool, like 18-inch Tyco sound or something. Cut out the hit, and then just take the reverb. And then maybe pitch it down and then run it through like a bit crusher or something. And it's like, oh, cool. Now we have like a hit sound, like an impact. There's a lot that can be done. A lot of it's just using weird plugins. I use a lot of the Yuhi Ubik stuff. He's the guy who created that company is Hans Zimmer's synth designer. So it's all very fussy, weird things that are not necessarily musical, you know, like they have some resonant pitch type of stuff that I don't think would be really great for guitar, but works great on a synthesizer, like creating an oscillating sound with pitch at the same time is a lot of fun. But most of mix sound for Doom Eternal is, if I were to like quantify it, I would say it's like 25% guitars and then the rest of it is sound design. So it's designing synths, it's designing sounds that are not necessarily musical, but are cinematic in nature, and then finding ways to manipulate it. And I think that's probably the other thing that's missing quite a bit too from a lot of the stuff that I hear is Mick is really big into knob turning, which is hard to replicate in a DAW if you don't have something that can control the functionality. Like if you want to change the way an envelope filter opens or something, you have to kind of just draw it in if you don't have a knob to turn. And that's where things start getting kind of weird. You can almost, it's like a blooming that happens to the sound, right? Like you have this bass play like a, you know, like Marcato style, just like boom. And you want that to not just be a stab. You want it to open into what it could sound like. But that style lives in distortion. That's probably the most important element of it.
What do you mean it lives in distortion? Like it's
on everything.
Like, distortion is on everything.
Like if it's not, it's like multi-level compression. Like my friend Jeff plays guitar has something called an Argent compressor. If you don't have it, it's really cool. It kind of acts like overstayers compressor. It's like OTT, over the top. I think it's Transfer Records makes that or something. It's like having like five of those on at the same time. And it makes anything scream. It's really cool. It's very neat, but it's not musical.
Were you doing this stuff? Were you producing and engineering stuff 10 years ago? Like Binary Records?
I would, I would do pre-production, which sounds like, you know, mangled dog shit basically at that point. But I've always just let professionals handle that stuff. I got real lucky, dude. Like I hit, it was like a waiting game, you know. There's a big name composer manager named Richard Kraft. He does like Danny Elfman's management and stuff since like Batman. And he said something really important once, which was it's a long game, right? Music's a long game. It could take you 15 years to break. Like you look at Lorna Shore. I remember those dudes like playing locally at one point. Now it's like Hideo Kojima is post, you know, the guy who did Silent Hill is posting about them.
Wow.
So, yeah, for some people, it just takes a long time. And for me, it was, I started Binary Code in 2004 and was touring at that point within a year and just always pushing and putting music out and like some, you know, blips and bleeps of what felt like success, but like quantifiably in retrospect or not necessarily anything to write home about. But at the time, like, you know, it's something new to me. Here I am, a 17-year-old in high school, just hoping my music is liked by at least like six people. Being able to like tour later on. Wow, cool. Like Leprous tour. Amazing. Pinnacle moment for me because I love that band and we became friends and, you know, that's great and everything like that. But now it's kind of like, okay.
It's a stepping stone.
Yeah, it's crazy. I never would have thought that. Like, I thought Binary Code was going to be my thing I'd die on. I'm sure a lot of us feel that way about the music we do is like, I can't do anything else. This is my thing. I can't go play. I know you played with like, what was that band there? The Heart Machine. Like you do got to take risks once in a while and go play with somebody else. But you know, your main thing is like, what do I create? And you want to ride that and hope that it turns into something. But the truth of the matter is a lot of people in bands, there's an individual guy in that band who is, or girl, whoever. There's that one person in the band with like the creative X factor, but also like the business and networking X factor that kind of takes their individuality into a greater position. And I think sometimes that happens. I'm very fortunate because much like you, like your band is filled with super talented people. And my band was too. It's just that sometimes people rest on the drive and determination of one person. And that can, that's just like carrying too much stuff. Like how long is it going to take you to get up a hill when you're carrying everybody else's backpack, you know? So.
Yeah. But there is something to say about being, like for the music I'm writing now, I am running the ship and it is really nice to have it, you know, to not negotiate stuff with a bunch of other people and to do things. And, but it also gives me the option to play shows duo and you know, the success of this is completely riding on how much work am I willing to put into it and care about it.
And you got a lot going on. Kids, that's a full-time job, you know, and the more you add to it, it's like having more needy employees, you know?
Yeah, it's tough.
I'm glad you keep doing it though. I've like, as a person who is endlessly searching for quality musicianship that's not just uncommonly creative but is also really good to listen to, it's like an endless hunt for like, I live in Austin, Texas now. For me, it's like trying to find good Italian bread. I can't find it. So that's what it's like finding music now. It's like there's too much shit. There's too much cosplaying of like what a genre is supposed to sound like, and it's too obvious. And you know, I was talking to somebody recently and they made a really good analogy that I really relate to. It's like you remember the clothing brand FUBU?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like for us, by us. Like our community is like a for us, by us brand in a lot of ways, right? So when somebody starts doing something and it's not really their thing, it sticks out like a sore thumb. It's like when somebody plays a metal character in a movie and it's like some dude who's like a nerd normally. And you're like, that's not a metal guy, dude. That's some nerd playing a metal guy. That's what music's kind of become in a lot of ways, because people are kind of restless about not succeeding because they see the concept of success always pushed down their throat. So they're always changing their mission objective to find the quickest way to success. And it's just not conducive for good in a lot of ways. It's really more conducive for just a lot of, you know, a lot of options for the same thing. You know, it's like,
mm-hmm. yeah,
It's just a weird thing to watch, and I'm glad you keep doing it, you know?
Well, I get, you know, those hater comments all the time. Like, well, I wouldn't say all the time, but like, oh man, but like the, you know, the Mayonnaise guitar solo I did years ago, that was not for us, by us. And the amount of hate I got in my Facebook inbox was outrageous. Like, this is not metal, you know, I didn't write it for you.
Are you talking about the competition one?
Yeah, yeah.
Oof. They hate us because they ain't us. That's what that is.
You know, the music I'm writing now, it's gotten some haters, like, you know, just like it wasn't, it's not music that fits nicely into, I guess, the heavy metal.
What are they saying, if you don't mind me asking? Let's address some of this. Can we do like a Nick Reed's angry tweets or something? Because, dude, I'd love to just, and give, at the end, give me their usernames. I'll go respond to any of it. I'd happily will just defend this. Not that it needs defending, but I mean, sometimes people just need, I've had people say some horrible shit about me, about like Mick Gordon stuff, and I respond to them, and then they're just like, oh dude, I'm sorry, you made a good point. It's like, oh, did you forget I was a human being for a second that you were talking about? You know, it's like the dehumanizing that happens over social media.
Let's see. What's what this one guy say?
That's always a good compliment. I get a lot of shitty advertisements for guitar. Dude, that's the reason why I'm trying to move away from Instagram, is I just can't deal with the like dude who's never written a song in his life trying to show you how to do stuff. It's like, dude, I don't know if you saw me post that thing, but it's like, it's like having a tourist recommend what food to get in an area. You know, it's like, I want somebody who lives in the area to tell me what to eat, not some dude who just visited for the first time.
Yeah. I guess I don't get that much. It's good. It's expanded in my head because it's, I find it offensive.
It happens but once. Yeah. You're just
like, it happens. I'm like, nah, let's see. Yeah.
It's probably like, oh, this is too jazzy. It's like, oh dude, I'm sorry. Why don't you just go listen to somebody else then? That's a good solution.
Yeah. Yeah.
They got to say something or they don't feel like they have a point.
That's kind of, it makes me feel sad for them. Like, can you imagine walking around every day and that's just where you are in your head, that you just feel the need to tell someone that they're not good enough at something, so you just got to blurt it out. But we've been down this road, like, you know, this is not going to change. It's just the way it is.
Some people just voice what's in their head, and a lot of us don't do that. Like, we might hear something and think to ourselves, like, this is dog shit. Like, do you have to say that? Is there anything constructive about just putting it down, or do you want to give it, you know, put some advice behind it? I saw a guy on Twitter the other day post a really talented composer who's worked on some cool stuff, and he posted like VST nylon guitar playing stuff and said it sounded great. And I was like, I can't not say something about this. Like, it sounds terrible to my ears. He's like, these contact nylon guitars sound really great. And it's like, bro, do you know how many people would love to just be a part of a game and would do it for free, frankly? Like, just, and it's nylon guitar. You can't go buy a $50 nylon guitar and just poop out this little simple, easy thing. It's frustrating, man. I say the same thing about metal, by the way, which I feel like I'm the only person representing our community in the composing world as aggressively as I am, because there's a lot of metal guys in the video game world. My friend, I was at GDC recently, which is game developers,
I was gonna ask you what that was. Yeah, GDC.
Yeah, it's really cool, man. Imagine NAMM, but for game developers. And the term game developer is basically anybody who works on a game is a game developer. The same way anybody who works on a film is a filmmaker, including a composer.
Composer, like animation people.
Anything.
What have you.
PR, yeah. Everything, yeah. So I was there and met with people who I've known, you know, digitally, and a lot of them are AAA game composers or audio guys, and they all love metal. It's really crazy how many people I was like, wow, we're here. Like, we're in here, but I don't know that. Why is that? Yeah. Why are we burying that?
Well, the jazz community is like that too. I haven't met a jazz musician in the past decade that doesn't listened to Meshuggah and like,
right.
You know, like when I started going to college, Meshuggah wasn't really that big of a thing amongst the jazz community. Yeah. And then as I left college, suddenly it was like, I was the weird one for liking Meshuggah and writing ever forthright music. It's like, I got to hear this. And now it's everywhere. Now I'm seeing some of my favorite straight ahead jazz guys posting, you know, drummers posting like their version of a Meshuggah rhythm on their jazz kit, or like a guitar player covering one of Frederick's weird patterns and applying it to like on a bass. Jazz.
Yeah.
Or yeah, whatever.
Or Bill Burr liking Meshuggah, which is
Bill Burr.
Insane. I know it's because his drum teacher, Dave Elitch, is a metal huge guy.
Fan or something.
Oh, I see. Yeah. We used his snare on Moon's Blood. He had a Crush brass snare that was at Audio Hammer when we were tracking, and we used it. And I'm like, who the hell is Dave Elitch? And then it's like, oh, he's the guy from the Mars Volta. And then fast forward, he's Bill Burr's drum teacher, and that's how he's, you know, I can imagine Bill Burr being like, dude, show me something crazy. And then Dave's like, all right, watch this. And then Bill Burr was probably like, what the fuck is this, dude? Come on.
I remember some blog post that was along the lines of, you know, Bill Burr can't stop raving about the Meshuggah show he saw.
How could you blame him? You know, you go from like a Led Zeppelin like cover band to seeing that, it's like, holy shit. Because that's, you know, he's into like old school stuff. And I think Meshuggah can be a gateway for any musician. I found Opeth to be the same thing back in the day too. Like I used to work at Sam Ash in New Jersey, like right across the bridge. And I would put on like Opeth Deliverance, like the live version of it, and or Damnation. I can't remember which one it was, but like jazz guys would come in, like Lenny White from Return to Forever, and be like, oh, who's this, man? This is awesome. And I was like, oh, this is Opeth, dude. This is like a Swedish death metal band that's doing prog music now. And he's like, dude, it sounds great. And I'm like, I love that transition, you know, between those two genres.
So something like GDC, are those guys also going to the Grammys, or are these like two different worlds? Like if you're, you know, a Grammy kind of composer, you know, you're not really hanging out at game development things and vice versa. Like, do you see yourself writing for like a Grammy artist, or are these really two very distinct worlds?
Well, believe it or not, game audio is now a category of the Grammys. So,
that's new.
I think it's been a couple of years, if I remember correctly, but my friend Austin Wintery, who was at GDC, he did the game Journey, and he did Aliens Fireteam. He was nominated for a Grammy twice, I believe, at this juncture. So it's becoming more and more prevalent, and the crossover is really the musicians who work on stuff. For example, Ludwig Göransson, who did Tenet, he's doing Oppenheimer, he did Mandalorian, he worked on Childish Gambino's record, so... No. I think there's crossover with our generation of composers. Maybe not so much the former, you know, like the Hans Zimmers. Although Danny Elfman's record, Big Mess, have you heard it?
No.
Dude, it's insane. It's Devin Townsend, but like way more cinematic and way crazier. Neely.
Well, I'm not going to write these down, but I'll probably hit you up later. Yeah. Like, give me all the list of things so good to listen to.
It's I don't know how to pronounce her name, Neely Broch. She played guitar on it, and she's a killer guitar player. And then I think Josh Fries is on drums. It's Danny Elfman plus Devin Townsend, which Devin Townsend's kind of a little Elfman-esque in his own ways, more kind of Broadway. But yeah, I think yes and no. Yes, we will do stuff for big stuff, because I'm always going to keep connected with bands. I'm always going to work with bands. And, you know, I obviously want to work my way into working with bands who are more focused on cinematic elements to their record too at moments. So if that's a bigger artist at some point, I'll definitely work on it.
Yeah. Yeah. For me right now, I am doing the band thing, the artist thing, but I've also only known music to be the reason I play guitar is to be the best guitar player that I can be, kind of thing.
Right.
And, you know, that's, you get those feelings when you're younger, you know, you're doing something right. You get the attention, you do the guitar contest, you play on stage and people like you. And then you get older and you start thinking like, does this change at all? Does the vision here just get, you know, is it just a bigger reward for the same type of vision, like a bigger shows, more popularity? You know, I'm constantly shaping my sound to, you know, you're always like fine tuning the recipe, like a little less of this, right, a little more of that. And you know, you have people that have been players their whole lives. Like Holdsworth was a player his whole life, and Wayne Krantz is another hero of mine, right, player his whole life. And John Scofield, a player his whole life. But we're also like in a different time now where I don't really see players anymore. I don't really see, like, maybe this is not entirely true, but like Pat Metheny and Eric Johnson, mm-hmm, and Holdsworth and Krantz, Scofield, like these were legends, right, or are legends. They're player legends, but you know.
And it was harder to be a legend at their time.
But I don't know if what we have now is, we have really great artists and we have really great players. I don't know if they're legends though, because eventually,
you think it's because, well, people are too accessible?
Yeah, maybe. Because, like, you know, when you saw Metheny back in the day, the only time you ever saw his face was when he was kind of coming to your town, or like when he released a DVD,
right,
and a lesson DVD or something. And now it's every day I see. I can you imagine like being a Zeppelin fan in the 70s and you go see them live? And like that was, it's like, there they actually are. Like, they're real. That's him. Like, I
couldn't
and
imagine.
The only comparison you have is like maybe a newspaper right, ad that like Led Zeppelin's coming. Like, that's gotta, like, be
you
nuts.
Got to see them live? That's crazy. Now it's like, I can watch it on YouTube. What do you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's the accessibility thing. I've always talked about how important mysticism is and why we see why certain bands had success at the times that they did. And I think it's the like element of the unknown that makes people create the idea of legend. I think that's why Mick is as successful as he is too, is because he's not very accessible. He doesn't really mess around with comment sections and post, you know, here's my bedroom, here's my dog, here's the cup of coffee I made. You know, there's like none of that.
Yeah.
It's like, when is he going to post something? And that's exciting. But when, mm-hmm, you're constantly sharing insight into every little thing you do in this world, it's just, it's too much. I mean, like Slipknot used to be that for me, where it was like, damn, Slipknot's cool. I don't know what these guys look like. And now it's like, I know what Corey Taylor looks like. And
Yeah. It was more fun that way. Well, that's why I stopped doing lessons like online for a little while. I was posting lessons and it was getting me some new followers. And, but one, I hated doing it. And two, I thought it like devalued my sound. Like, yeah, I don't need to tell you how the sauce is made. It kind of, right, kind of defeats the whole fun of it.
So like new guitar players, is there really a legend? I think the closest thing to that would probably be maybe like Tozen could be close to that, but he's also so accessible now. Like if you go to NAMM, like he's there at his booth representing his guitars and you can talk to him and it's, yeah, like, nah, dude, like you want that Frederick Tordendahl thing going on where it's, when's he going to post something?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, is that the distinction? Because when I think of Thorndahl, I think legend.
Right.
And I totally think maybe that has something to do with some of the mysticism. And no, I don't think that as much when I think of Tosin, although I love Tosin.
Right.
Like, I don't think it as much, but it may have to do with the fact that he's so accessible and almost in part, largely a marketing figure.
Yeah, and maybe part of it too, maybe there's like a trigger point from removing that potential genetic predisposition for being a legend is like, don't take pictures inside your house or something. You know, like don't show us your bedroom or your living room. You know, as soon as we
don't do podcasts.
Don't do podcasts. Be cool with just being famous and not like having to feel it all the time. You know, like just be cool being successful. Don't look for the constant endless stream of, you know, affirmation from people. You know, I feel like some of these guys thrive off of being looked up to. And I don't think that's where Frederick, I mean, I remember Lamb Goat posting about, they did an interview with Meshuggah, or somebody did, and they were like, hey, do you know who the Acacia strain is? They're like, nope, never heard of him. Have you heard Periphery? Nope, never heard of him. It's yeah. like, there was a lot of like, no, I've never heard of the bands that sound like us. And I think that's because those guys don't listen to the stuff that they influence. You know, they listen to, what was that band? There was like a Japanese band that Meshuggah listened to on their like 96 documentary, where it's like really out of tune, shitty guitar playing by these these girls. I can't remember what they're called. My girlfriend knows exactly who I'm talking about, but it's like really bad. That's what Fredrik Dordendal wants to listen to, or Mats Morgan Band or something, you know, Bjork.
Yeah.
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 So a lot of these guys are just so caught up in, but you also have to remember that a lot of these bands came out from this moment of metal where it was really at its lowest. We felt that too, right? Like 2010 mm-hmm. was like, is metal going to survive? I don't know.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, yeah. So I'm at that point now with my music where I'm wondering, okay, do I take this the player route? Do I keep on working on my craft? Am I in my own way trying to be like a legend, you know,
right?
Not necessarily a legend, but a version of the people that I've always listened to and looked up to.
I think what you do is, because you can play piano too. I saw you playing some like Rhodes piano stuff. Yeah. I think a lot of the people that do the most with their music, that push things into the trajectory of reaching the common ear, are people who are exceptionally skilled at their instrument, but know how to like dial it back and just do stuff that sounds amazing using their chord vocabulary, their technique, their musician network. And I think of like Robert Glasper, for example. It's like mm-hmm. probably the best living musician on the planet right now, in my opinion. He's absolutely yeah. crazy. But he also knows how to write Grammy winning songs. Like if he's nominated for a Grammy in a category, forget about it. You're not going to win. Doesn't matter how many things you sold, it's going to win. And it's because he knows how to be the best, you know, Thelonious Monk style piano player, but then also knows how to write like the sickest kind of 90s R&B meets, you know, like, I don't even know how to explain it at this juncture, because he's kind of created a genre that people don't even really give him credit for. But, you know, he's just ultra talented.
So can you be, do you think, in rock, jazz, fusion, something that I might exist in, is it possible to be a player / producer / composer and not dabble in engineering and not dabble in mixing? Because I could see myself doing that, you know, being kind of being like a, you know, a thought leader on an album, but a producer, but not necessarily dabbling in mixing, because that's one thing I've never really wanted to commit the time to.
Same.
is mixing and that sort of stuff. I just care too much about my instrument and like
right.
and song and form and style to get into it.
I'm in the same way, dude. That's why like Lever and I have kind of teamed up and started a business together, is because he does something that I can't do, and he does it. He's unique enough where people are like constantly reaching out to him, which is hard to do in metal these days. And he's also it's not obvious, but it is sometimes. But like one of the characteristics of an amazing composer or creative is usually like how much they love music or the art that they're into, and George is one of those guys. So like that's why I work with him. I'm not going to bother. I don't have time to get good at training my ears for that stuff. There's no time for it. And it's also like, if you're not passionate about it, then don't do it. Have somebody else do it. You know, you're passionate about guitar and composing and writing, just focus on what you're good at and let somebody else do it. But it comes down to, do you have the money? Do you have the resources? All that kind of stuff. But I mean, dude, you could be composing for something. I don't know. You could be writing tracks for, I'm trying to think of like there is room for jazz in film and TV, you know, it does exist. And even hearing like Pliny, for example, I hear a guy who could be an anime composer in a lot of ways. I've wanted to actually talk to him about that at some point, you know, like reaching out to him and just being like, hey dude, have you ever thought about like trying to put this to visuals. It's not an easy task. It's a long road, but like he could definitely do it. And same thing with Aaron. Aaron can do it too. You know, a lot of the
animal stuff, big time.
Yeah.
Can definitely be animated. Well, how do you mean put it to visual? Like include visuals as part of your album? Like you work on the visuals yourselves?
No, or? I think just writing music, like finding an opportunity to do music, whether it's linear themes for like a video game or an anime thing, you know, because like, for example, my friends at Riot write linear themes for characters that get announced in their game for their esports stuff. And it'll be like one that you actually might like a lot is the theme for Kaisante. He's like this huge character in the game and he's from Africa and they're like, cool, let's write something amazing that like sounds like Africa, but matches this huge character personality of this video game character that's going to be playable. And they wrote some absolutely insane stuff. And, it's a really cool thing to do with your music, to think about story and to think about concept, as much as you think about how am I executing this sound, it's got to match something. Which is much easier than it sounds, honestly, because imagine a scene in a movie. It's like, how do you determine pace? How do you determine tone? What type of reverbs do you use for this scene that you're in? What's, you know, what's the environment? What's everything made out of? What's the character going through? That's a lot to think about when writing music, and it's got to match. Otherwise, it sticks out like a sore thumb. So it's really fun, but it's also it's a good challenge for us who get bored on our instrument, you know, like, I'm sure you've crossed that point where you're just like, I can do anything I want on this instrument at this point. Like, where's the limit on this? And when do I have to move on and do something weird? And it's, do I start learning left-handed or something? You know, like, what do I do? Yeah. And I'm speaking for you, by the way. I'm not even on the same planet as you're playing, but like, you get bored at some point. Like, you can do so much with it. Well, then move on and do something challenging. And writing for visual stories is, it's really challenging because you have to think outside of meters.
It's also a little scary. Like if I've spent the last 20, someone asked me the other day on Instagram, how long have you been playing? And I was like, so about 21 years, I guess. And those 21 years, it's always been, okay, time to practice. What are we going to work on today? Well, this is a cool pattern. Let me bring that through all 12 keys. I'll spend the next 3 days like working on variations of that. Okay, cool. Now it's part of my vocabulary. And, you know, that's
now what?
That's it. And now it's like, okay, I'm back to writing music. How do we change this up? Do I want to change this up? Like, oh shit, we're going to change this up. Here we go. Like this next album, I'm going to write like shit. I'm going to, you know, my wife got me into The National and the band The National, just kind of a little bit. And, for years, I was like, oh, this is so boring. I'm going to fall asleep listening to this thing. And then I saw them live, and I just thought they were such a good live band. They did cool things. Like, he was, like, playing the guitar a little bit, but then he would go over and grab a guitar on a stand and just, like, bang it on the ground and just, like, the resonance of the strings.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, it was just, like, droning. Like, it was, like, in some tuning, and he would just pick it up by the headstock and knock it on the ground a little bit, get the guitar to shake, and he'd put it back on the stand, and it would just sit there and rumble. Like for a little bit, and he'd go back to playing the guitar and those sorts of things. That's pretty
cool. I've never even heard of it. I'm like, I kind of want to see that.
Yeah, it was cool. And I was like, who is this guy? I feel like he's got some cool ideas. And he did a couple different things like that. And it turns out one of the guitar players is like someone who works a lot with Philip Glass and does more of that modern orchestral chamber music composition. Yeah. And then his brother, who's the other guitar player, does like more writing with Taylor Swift and things. So you got like one pop guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And a part of me feels like, you know, I could do that. I just have to, you know, tomorrow when it's okay, you know, kids are at daycare, work is light today, let's enter a music state of mind. Maybe I shouldn't just start practicing for the next 3 hours. Maybe I should...
like write something.
Yeah, just come up with a new... Just do something different, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of where the impetus starts for a lot of people. Colin Stetson is a really big, he was in Arcade Fire. I think he still is, but now he's doing like, he did the Hereditary movie with Ari Aster, which was a huge success. And he worked on Red Dead Redemption 2. And he's doing a lot of really cool composer related stuff, but he's a sax player from a huge band, you know, like these guys remove the limitation. Also, maybe not a lot of people know that they can step outside of what they're doing already, right? Like, I didn't know that I could pivot. I thought I was just going to be in a metal band forever. And then I was like, mm-hmm. oh, cool, I can always do this, but I have to be cool pivoting to find a career too. And that's a lot of people.
Paul Masvidal, I was talking to on here a couple months back, and he, you know, he's done a similar thing. Some acoustic songwritery stuff, and some of his tunes have been on, I think, Small Town. It was like a Superman spinoff. Oh,
Smallville,
type thing.
Yeah.
Smallville, yeah. And I just thought that was cool. I had no idea. I always knew him growing up as like the guitar player for Cynic, and and before him and I spoke, I just, you know, looked up to what he's been up to since, you know, since like the last time I really was cranking Cynic in my car, and I just discovered all these things that he's done. And you know, now it's just been a recurring thought of mine, especially since I just put out some new music and I'm already feeling like the bug to start thinking about what's next.
Right. So he's doing like sync licensing? Is that what he's doing?
Oh, geez, I don't know. Don't get me to do a...
Yeah, so basically like sync licensing is you write tracks without a cue or a story in mind, but you write based in, you know, like what's the... What vibe am I trying to hit? Okay, cool. This would be perfect for the Real Housewives of Atlanta or whatever it was. And then you write something that like kind of fits with that. And then you put it in a library that gets distributed to music supervisors and film editors. And then they put it in and you get a royalty.
It might be something along those lines because, I don't want to say anything totally incorrect, but the way that I was reading up on this prior to him and I were talking was that he had written some music and it was picked up because it seemed fitting for like the intro song of
Sounds like sync licensing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is great, by the way. It's good money, especially if the show's on TV, which Smallville is. You get quarterly revenue. So regardless of whether or not, you know, that show is popular. I mean, well, it has to be popular, but it's regardless of whether or not people know about the show. If it's popular on TV, you know, for people who watch cable still, that's money every time somebody's watching it. That's crazy. So that's
I would like for that to happen, except I'd need to probably find a lane a little bit. My music right now is more of a resume. Like,
right.
You know, look at all the stuff I can do.
Yeah, but I think that's a huge asset, dude. Like, my problem with most people in my field is people seem in a lane. That's a problem. Mm. You got to be able to do a lot. The more variety you can do, the more clients you can have. You know, it's like you can probably do so much more than other people just because you get kind of creatively restless and you want to go do different things. Just apply it to with intention, you know, because a lot of what we do is it's not rhetorical. We just write for fun. And if you write with intention, then you can find clients. I would say like a good balance would be like 25% of your revenue coming in from just streaming revenue from a TV show licensing a track, and that TV show gets syndicated or put on TV and it's a hit, you know, and that's just money printed every time it's on TV. You don't have to do anything. And that's a good safety net. And then the other thing could be writing bespoke music for people who need it for a specific reason on a show. Like you get a call where it's like, hey, can you write something like this for this commercial or something? And then, cool, man, the all-in budget's 30 grand. Make it happen. And then 50% can be do whatever you want with music. You know, have fun with it.
Yeah. I was listening to you talk a little bit about like the 8-hour contract in a year for...
Oh, dude.
You know, it's like writing... So intense. You got the gig to write some video game music, but... You got to do eight hours of music in a given year, which comes out to a minute and change of fully produced music a day, right?
A minute and 40 seconds would be the typical demand for like a 6 hours of music done over a course of a year.
Fuck, man. I see myself getting into that and being, after 2 weeks, thinking to myself, this was not the good choice. Right. Good choice. Yeah. I should have kept my day job and kept music on the side as a passion.
But a lot of people are working in teams now. So you might have like, let's say it's 3 hours of audio that's due within a year for a big game. Then you have, and you have like four people working on it with you, then you can break it down and deliver, you know, within a reasonable time. It is a lot of work, because the problem that we run into as people who write original music is, we write when we're inspired, and the composing world is very much you write regardless of whether or not you want to or not. And frankly, if anybody listening to this for some reason doesn't understand the distinguishable difference between those two things, there's that moment where you're like, I don't really feel like doing shit today. But it's like, what if you have a client tomorrow that's waiting for music and that's going to determine how much money you make going forward? Then you have to say to yourself, well, I'm going to go write music anyway. I know I don't want to. Somehow, 20 to 30 minutes after you force yourself into writing something, you don't even realize that you didn't want to do this an hour ago. It just disappears.
I talk about this a lot in, as it pertains to practicing and just getting to it. And I always equate it to jumping into a cold pool.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
shocking.
Like, you know, you're like, fuck, this water's cold. You dip your toe in, I don't want to do it. But as soon as you do it, you jump in. What is it? 2 minutes later, you normalize. You're like, this is fine.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? And people who are great at practicing, it is a different skill set you learn. Cause like, Sydney, my girlfriend, she's, you know, she has a master's degree in piano and film composing from NYU, which is great. She's an amazing practitioner. She teaches every single day. And that's awesome. But then when it's like, hey, go write something, it's like, fuck, I don't know what to do. And it's like, because it's another muscle you have to train. It's the creative muscle. It's just different. It's not harder. It's just take the practicing ethic of I have to do this even though I don't want to, and apply it to writing. That's all it is. But you and I should have a separate chat, because I don't want to say that it's wasted talent, because obviously like writing your music is, for people like me, it's like, thank God that you write music like you do, because I need something that challenges me to think a little bit when I'm listening. But I think that there's no reason why you shouldn't be, you know, doing anything outside of the songwriter world. You should definitely be doing something more than that. So I'd love to talk to you more about doing that for sure.
Yeah, I'd love to hear an outside perspective on like a lane that you know, I could kind of be inspired to lean into. You know, again, like seeing this band, The National, that seems to be something I'd like to try, because it was a little bit edgy, a little experimental, but also very listenable.
Send me a couple tracks that you like from them so I have an idea, because if I jump into it, I'll probably get like their music video number one hit or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'll send you something. Cool. I'll take a note to remind myself.
Dude, I'm just laughing at this Paul Masvidal thing where it says he was in the film Bully. Have you ever seen that movie?
No.
Dude, it's disturbing. And also, this is one of the untrue facts from what I can tell, but it's a movie with Brad Renfro, who was like popular in the 90s. He was an actor. And it's like a movie about like bullies who get in with these kids, and there's like, it's just such a traumatic movie, dude. It's one of the most traumatic movies probably in history. Like, it's not a good one to watch if you don't have like a good stomach for horrible stuff. But I just love that it's saying like Paul Masvidal from Cynic was in the movie Bully. It's like, no, dude, don't be in that movie, first off. And secondly, that's not true. That's just really a funny fact.
This is really a hoot. I'm definitely going to take you up on chatting more about.
Yeah, absolutely. Love to.
About, you know, songwriting opportunities and that sort of stuff. But I wonder if there's like a fun question we can ask this thing before we.
Who invented djent?
Oh, that's a good one.
Oh, hey, accurate.
There we go. Meshuggah, a Swedish metal band that has been active since the 1980s. True. Meshuggah uses polymeter, heavy palm muted riffs. Another band often cited as the influence of djent is Sixth.
Yeah, I would agree with that too.
Yeah, British progressive metal band that was active in the early 2000s. Other bands are, of course, Periphery, Animals, Leaders, Tesseract, and Viljarta. You know, they didn't include Fell Silent.
Yeah, that's a shame.
You know, Fell Silent is definitely like neck and neck with right? Sixth. Same time?
Yeah, Sixth. I would say so. I mean, Sixth, like, for sure were the pioneers, because I guess the lineage there actually would be that Fell Silent was very inspired by Sixth, and Tesseract was very. I would replace Tesseract with Textures.
Fell Silent. Oh,
because I remember Ackle used to always have the dudes from Textures over at his house when they would tour through back in like the early 2000s. So I would say like for the like let's throw a saxophone into, you know, like really ambient kind of Meshuggah related stuff with like crazy drum patterns and really heavy guitar tones, Tesseract was way after Textures. And then Periphery very easily more inspired by Sixth than I would say Meshuggah for sure. Animals as Leaders, though, that's a complicated one. That's like more like the Wooten brothers than anything, right?
Yeah.
And then Viljarta, forget it. I don't know what Kale and Buster are doing in that band, but they're from a different planet. I don't get it. That's a pretty accurate answer, though.
Whatever. Tell me a joke about a metal musician and a jazz musician. Oh, boy. Why did the metal musician refuse to play with the jazz musician? Because every time the jazz musician said, "Let's improvise," the metal musician thought he was being asked to sacrifice a goat on stage.
Oh, that's good.
Let's see. Let's try another one. A metal musician and a jazz musician walk into a... By the way, these don't exist. This thing is making this up.
That's crazy.
A metal musician and a jazz musician walk into a bar. The metal musician says to the bartender, "Give me the strongest drink you've got." The jazz musician says, "I'll have a martini, but hold the gin, hold the vermouth, and just give me a glass of olives." The metal musician looks at the jazz musician and says, "What's wrong with you, man? Are you afraid to drink or something?" The jazz musician responds, "No, I just prefer my music to be more sophisticated than my drinks."
It was basically implying that metal musicians are alcoholics. I love that. Damn, dude. I need to sit and mess with this. This could be a rabbit hole.
Well, soon this will be writing music, too.
Yeah, oh well. That's okay. Well,
maybe not.
Hey, frankly, if people are dumb enough to consume shit written by a computer and it doesn't really, like, if it doesn't matter to them... That's already existing right now, dude. What's the difference between that and some Swedish producer writing the top, you know, pop hits?
Yeah.
It's not like there's no soul in it in the first place. Who cares?
Yeah. I wonder if I can get more specific, like
maybe a death metal musician and like a jazz fusion musician. I don't know. Maybe do like Fredrik Thorndahl and George Benson or something.
Show me a conversation between Fredrik Thorndahl and George Benson. I don't know how that currently. Here's a hypothetical conversation. Fredrik Thorndahl. "Hey, George, it's great to meet you. I've been a big fan of your jazz guitar playing for years. Thanks, Fredrik. I've heard some of your music too, and I'm impressed by your unique approach to guitar playing." Fredrik Thorndahl. "Yeah, I try to incorporate a lot of experimental and progressive elements into..." Oh, this is just boring.
It's too pedagogical. I get it.
Yeah, well, I started playing in jazz clubs. Do you think there are similarities between jazz and metal? Yeah, this almost sounds like a class. Like, okay, right. Everyone watch the video of Fredrik Thorndahl and George Benson talking about music.
This is trippy.
I wish I were more creative. See, if we grew up with AI, we would know how to really mess with this thing.
Yeah, kids, you know? Kids who are 10 years old right now are going to be writing everything.
Yeah. Awesome hanging out. Yeah, I'll definitely catch you soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, dude.